Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 71, section 7, which is old single column page 806. Okay, we have these final two sections of this paper on the development of the state. As you can see, both sections have lists in them, so they're giving us some closing precision, if you will, clarity on some key issues. We had a very, very important hierarchy in section 7 here, at the end of section 7. We don't really need to do too much besides probably just remember the very last thing that we touched on at the end of the preceding session that you'll see them mentioning is the profit motive, right? That little three paragraph section 6 on the profit motive. Remember, we finally got the fourth indispensable to the progress of early civilizations with the profit motive, and how that one definitely has a long tail that extends into the second phase as you shift the balance from, almost all profit motive to begin with until you've left it behind, way, way, way down the road in advancing civilization. But it takes a very, very long time for that not to be an indispensable element of see that what's technically still individuals in advancing civilization that are part of the first phase. It isn't a simplistic thing where just magically one day every single person on the planet crosses the threshold from early to advancing civilization. It's not like when the finite is transcended collectively and everything becomes absentite, where literally everything in being is simultaneously being taken across that threshold.
It's not suddenly.
Right, it's a very gradually, it's gradually in both directions. You're bringing in service motive and you're gradually tailing off profit motive. Okay, so the other little thing up front, you see the title of Section 7, Education. Remember that it's not surprising there would be a whole section on that issue. Remember back in Section 2 when we had that list of 10, there are 10 steps or stages to the evolution of a practical and efficient form of representative government. And we were testing ourselves against that list. It's like, well, okay, step one, step two. Oh, no, step two. the education one. Remember it said freedom of the mind. Unless a free people are educated, taught to think intelligently and plan wisely, freedom usually does more harm than good. So it's all wonderful to do step one and, eliminate literal physical slavery and such things. But if you aren't challenging those freed individuals to find their human nature and educate it upward, it's going to be worse than when everyone was in bondage in terms of civilization. Okay, so education, very, very important. Let's see what they have to say here.
Section 7, Education.
The enduring state is founded on culture, dominated by ideals, and motivated by service. The purpose of education should be acquirement of skill, pursuit of wisdom, realization of selfhood, and attainment of spiritual values.
Okay, so two simple sentences, one little paragraph, an opening point of reflection. So you've got founded on culture. Right? It's, as we've seen them stress, I mean, we were just stressing with the profit motive. Right? The fruits of the evolutionary process indeed have value. You know, everything is predicated on that foundation. So founded on culture, you have genuinely humanly conscious individuals who have a recognition of genuine ideals. You know, so that's a dominant influence. Spirit dominates mind, and you are directing that outward. It's not just all about you establishing some island universe transcendence. You're encircuiting yourself. It flows down in from above into you and down and out to others and completes the circuit back into the cosmos. All right, so motivated by service. Then that second sentence, the purpose of education, that should remind you of another sentence. All right, the final paragraph of paper 16, section 6. You know, you go, well, is this going to be at odds with that? Remember what it says back there? It is the purpose of education to develop and sharpen these innate endowments of the human mind. What do they mean by these innate endowments? The three cosmic intuitions. Your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That foundational engagement of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. So let's think about that. I mean, you know, I'm always holding that up, that you know, that is the total essence of the fact summed up in that paragraph, that the purpose of education is to develop and sharpen, you know, relationship to the three cosmic intuitions. So here when they say the purpose of education should be, and they have this whole list, let's think about it. Should be the acquirement of skill. Okay, well, when you know that fundamentally, sort of in a very precise technical way, it's what's back there in paper 16, section 6, do we mean fancy animal skill? Right? You have some initial ability that you have as a fancy animal, genetically, right? And you're building human skill upon that foundation. Right? What's the foundation of your human nature there? Right? The relationship to the cosmos through the three cosmic intuitions. And so it enlightens, you know, what they mean more precisely by that acquirement of skill. Not just, all of the minutiae of an elaborate fancy animal culture.
Not just being a carpenter for Nazareth.
Right, but you know, but if you are a carpenter from Nazareth, right? No, that's a good point, right? And so it's like, well, okay, so what if you are a carpenter of Nazareth, right? To bring a human aspect into that, not just, you know, you're the fanciest animal carpenter ever, right? But what does it mean to bring a human insight, you know, down from above, as you engage carpentry? I mean, that's you know, or any other thing, you know, in terms of a skill. What does that mean? You know, just for you to start reflecting on that, right? It's the purpose of education to try to, you know, pass this discovery on as more and more humans sort of understand what that means, right? You know, you pass it on.
Yeah, in an earlier teaching, so this isn't from the Grinch book, but we had the idea that life wasn't real until you learn to do one thing well. If you learn to do one thing well, then it gives you an insight on how all things can be done well.
Yeah.
It does say that.
Yeah, yeah.
It does say that.
And
oh, it does say that.
Yeah, okay. and not only that, but I see. But then that just feeds back around again. Well, what does it mean to do something well? Right. It means that it conforms with the cosmos. Okay. How do I know what the cosmos is? Through your cosmic intuitions. Right. That's how you know the definition of well. It's one thing. You know, if you don't know the genuine definition of well, then that's just a platitude. And you say, it's like, oh, it feels so wonderful to say that. Right? But it has no substance to it until you have real definitions for terms in your sentences. Otherwise, it's just platitudes. Right? Okay, so acquirement of skill. Pursuit of wisdom. Again, you have an experience. Remember, it's literally an experience with tribulation. Right? The only way you can acquire wisdom is through tribulation. Right? But how does wisdom result? Is it just automatic? You know, you go through troublous times and voila, you know, you're wise afterwards. No, you have to use your insight, right, to penetrate into that experience and to draw the wisdom out of it. Right? Wisdom's not possible without insight first. Right? No animal can have wisdom. Right? And again, the seventh adjutant is just the spirit of wisdom. Right? It's not wisdom. Right? You don't just get encircled in the seventh adjutant and voila, you have infinite wisdom. No, it's just as an energy, it's just an urge, you know, and even when you bring in your encirclement of the Holy Spirit, still just in and of itself, it's just an impulse. It's just a philosophic impulse. It's not philosophy. Right? Right. Obviously, if you're going to pursue wisdom, first you must take delight in cultivating, right? That develop and sharpen, as they said, back there in 16:6, of your insight, so that wisdom acquirement is possible. And it's like if you can't draw wisdom out of a tribulation, it's because you don't have deep enough insight. You need to take delight in cultivating until you can penetrate deep enough into it to draw wisdom out of it. Realization of selfhood. Again, I have my animal origin self. If I'm going to realize that self, if I'm going to get that self engaged and predicated on eternity, right, how do I do that? Snap my fingers and magically it happens? No, again, the only way that I can reach out, you know, and have insight and hence potential connection beyond that self is through the three cosmic intuitions. So again, you know, they're the foundation of how you realize the self. Right? I mean, remember, you can, in 16:6 there, it even says it's the purpose of personality to unify the three. Obviously, the personality is involved in that realization of selfhood. The attainment of spiritual values. Again, right, it's the Holy Spirit. Right, it's your means of, I mean, how can you even have the recognition of value in the first place? Through the third cosmic intuition. So again, it's just a way of taking that very, succinct, direct statement of the fact of the purpose of education and fleshing it out a little bit so that you can, you know, it becomes less abstract, less theoretical, and more tangible, understandable what we're talking about. Okay. But you can see it still remains. There isn't any more fundamental statement of the purpose of education than what's in 16:6. And the same is true for all the other things there in terms of, you know, they bring up the purpose of civilization, the purpose of life, the purpose of religion, and the purpose of personality. So anywhere in the book, if you see something else about, say, the purpose of religion, right, you should be able to take it back to that foundation of the purpose of religion is to ennoble the three cosmic intuitions. And anything else that you think is the purpose of religion is not genuine religion. Right? It's reminding you of what the word religion means, as opposed to what humans have always thought it means. And it really doesn't have anything hardly at all to do with anything that has been the way it's been used in all of human history. Like they point out, I mean, basically all religion has ever been, still is completely for many on the planet, and mostly for everyone else on the planet, it's just fear. it's fear by another name. You know, the religion of fear, the religion that is fear. That's what that of means in the religion of fear. It's just fear with lots of rationalization schemes, you know, tied to it. Okay, so so you see how they just started you out. That's what they wanted you to do with that one little paragraph. Is get yourself in that whole very grounded in the fifth epical revelation mode. That's where they're going here. That if you do genuinely initiate yourself as a human founded in the three cosmic intuitions, then you build up from there. And where do you build up from there? What's the physics of the stages up from there? That's what they're moving toward at the end of this section. But you got to begin first. All right, what else do they say?
In the ideal state, education continues throughout life, and philosophy sometimes becomes the chief... I think my book is different.
Sometime becomes. It's not that sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. No, sometime it becomes, period.
Is your word separated?
Yeah.
Mine has a hyphen after the sum. Okay. And philosophy,
sometime.
No S. Okay. And philosophy, sometime, becomes the chief pursuit of its citizens. The citizens of such a commonwealth pursue wisdom as an enhancement of insight into the significance of human relations, the meanings of reality, the nobility of values, the goals of living, and the glories of cosmic destiny.
Okay, so... So in the ideal state, what's the bottom line there? All the details aside, where is this all going? Philosophy. Right? Philosophy sometime becomes, at some point, right, in the development of civilization, philosophy is the chief pursuit of its citizens. Not religion, not science. The context for religion and science, the whole philosophy. Not merely human philosophy, not merely the lower hemisphere, right, but the whole sphere. Right? The only way you can get there is with the augmentation of divine revelation. So that you can have the full sphere of philosophy. You're obviously not going to be able to get to advancing civilization without divine revelation. Because you can't get the full sphere of philosophy. Yeah. See, again, it doesn't matter how long you evolve bottom up, you can never acquire the half that can only be achieved from the top down. Right? It can only be given to you, you know, that perspective that you cannot access, no matter how long and how earnestly you try. Right? There wouldn't be revelations on worlds if it wasn't, you know, an inescapable element of the process. They would just wait long enough, right? You wouldn't need princes and staves and Adam and Eves and, you know, and all that rigmarole, magisterial sons, whatnot. You wouldn't need any of that if it all just is a matter of just letting enough time roll by. Right?
Our planet is kind of an example of what are we like without revelations up to a point?
Yeah.
I mean, because the two of them kind of screwed up. But, you know what I mean?
Yes, like, right.
You're right. I mean, so what they do when they talk about revelation, though, they do, when they describe it, they do say it's a way of shortening, you know, just the process of long-time evolution, so to speak.
Yeah, let's just, you know, I mean, the simple reason, you know, another reason why you can understand that there's an emergency that's a philosophic emergency that's developed. You reach the apex of what you can do bottom up on this world, you know, around roughly the beginning of the 20th century. And if you don't bring in divine revelation, if you don't bring in that metaphysics, that true metaphysics, that upper hemisphere, all of the acquirements through evolution of that lower hemisphere will be quickly lost. See? Because, I mean, if for no other reason, you know, a long time ago, humans figured out that you needed a metaphysics, right? You needed that big picture context. And the more humans tried to generate one themselves, the more absurd they, you know, the constructs became, and the more people looking at that from the outside just said, oh, this is all just a bunch of baloney, right? The horrendous constructs in the name of metaphysics is basically the main reason why philosophy was thrown out at the beginning of the 20th century. So you need, you know, if you don't have the magisterial sun, you need the Urantia book to give you that upper hemisphere, to give you the true metaphysics. Otherwise, you can't go forward, and you will quickly lose everything that you gained. In our case, 2,500 years evaporated in a few decades. This is very important. You know, what they're saying here, you know, and, you know, let's just, you know, another way you can think about that. Remember what happens. You know, we're in the material comfort era. We're trying to push forward. What's the name of the next developmental epic? The quest for knowledge and wisdom. Right? Number four is the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right? Philosophy. And it's knowledge and wisdom, not wisdom and knowledge. Right? Wisdom is the foundational one. Again, philosophy is the foundation. And the chief pursuit, quality of thinking, you know, quivering on the very brink. What? Well, it's like, well, what about after that? Isn't it just some sort of mystical religious thing after that? No. The next one is the epic of philosophy and brotherhood. See, once you see that it's like, and, you know, what they said here, you know, that going forward, it's philosophy is a chief pursuit, period, you know, forever into the endless depths of light and life. You know, when you go to the next one, the age of spiritual striving, right, that totally recasts what that's about. Right? That's Holy Spirit, right? That's not just a disembodied part, a unity part, taken off onto weird tangents. And then obviously the era of light and life is, you know, you're really living, you know, and this is a cosmic illumination of your mind, as you're talking about. It's not what you initially imagine when you have no cosmic consciousness and you have just primitive spiritual consciousness, and you hear about, you know, the age of spiritual striving and the year of light and life. You're imagining something very, very false, what those are like, what those ages are like. You know, they're so completely beyond your imagination because they're predicated on a wholeness that you have yet to even begin to experience. You're just extrapolating apart. So in that mode, if I extrapolate apart into an imagined whole in the era of light and life, what am I producing? Some extremism, right, is my vision of light and life. No wonder there's such a tendency these days for everyone to go off into isms, right? It's because that's what, you know, in a, unconsciously, they're trying to establish light and life.
Particularly in our institutions of higher learning, education.
Yeah, so-called either, higher learning, yeah.
Either one ideology or a different one, you know. Hmm. But it's more indoctrination. It's becoming more and more part of it.
Right. It becomes less and less holistic, more and more linear, more and more extreme. You know, rigid, linear, ideological conformity. You know, whereas the whole point of a college and then subsequent universities is to break you out of the line that you're born into and try to introduce you to the whole, to the fruits of human philosophy, to the fruits of reflective thinking, you know, and the degree to which we've recognized the whole up to that point in human history. Yeah, okay, so philosophy is the chief pursuit of its citizens, not some of its citizens, you know, all of it, all the citizens. The citizens of such a commonwealth pursue wisdom as an enhancement of insight. Right? What was I saying? You put insight to use on your experiences and you can draw wisdom out of it. And like I was saying, if you can't draw wisdom out of it, you need to enhance, you need to increase the elevation of, enhance, you know, have more depth of insight, right? Until you can draw the wisdom out of it. That's just exactly what they're saying there in that sentence, see? And you're applying it to insight into the significance of human relations. See, again, so applying your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions in terms of human relations. Insight into the meanings of reality. Insight into the nobility of values. Insight into the goals of living. Insight into the glories of cosmic destiny. It's all about the three cosmic intuitions. And again, they're talking about civilization. It is the purpose of civilization to express them. Right? What does it say up there in 16:6? All they're doing, see, is just expanding on what they told you in the end of 16:6. So it isn't so abstract and intangible, theoretical to you. All right, what else do they say?
Your ancients should get a vision of a new and higher cultural society. Education will jump to new levels of value with the passing of the purely profit-motivated system of economics. Education has too long been localistic, militaristic, ego-exalting, and success-seeking. It must eventually become worldwide, idealistic, self-realizing, and cosmic grasping.
Okay, so I told you the profit motive thing. See, would come around. There it is. So it's one of the things we can look toward, when they say Urantians should, so you want to be thinking about that as a corollary. The more that you're trying to move yourself or working on moving a sector of society forward in that transition of what proportion is profit motive and what proportion is service motive, that you've got this this transition in education that's in parallel with that. And we talked about how the transition there from profit motive to service motive is in both senses gradual, but you notice what they said there, right? There's a saltation, there's a suddenly education will jump to new levels. So even though the evolutionary process in the collective is a gradual thing, suddenly there will be a phase change in the system of education. Right? You'll reach a critical level in the transition where relative education, you'll have this jump. And obviously, if everyone feeds into that education system that's now at a higher level, that's going to accelerate the transition going forward. So it may be gradual, but the time constant will shorten. Once you have that... that new predicate, educational predicate, that every citizen is based on. Okay, and then they give you a great, look at that wonderful pairing. Localistic on, going to worldwide. Militaristic, going to idealistic. Ego-exalting, going to self-realizing. So, like, for instance, instead of, like we talked about before, instead of taking self-respect falsely up, the ego-exalting thing they're talking about, up to self-esteem and self-admiration, instead of that false exaltation, right, you turn things around and you bring that connection to eternity, that relationship to the cosmos, down in. And just transform it at its appropriate level, and instead of falsely exalting it, you instead of essentially giving it more quantity, you give it more quality. Okay. And so, quality of thinking. Remember, so you can see that transition. Right now we have this tendency. I mean, the very fact that we so fixate on quantity actually feeds into that whole ego-exalting thing. We have a tendency, if you think of levels, they're quantity levels, not quality levels.
Okay. It seems like I said a lot of these, to some degree, people don't have a clear vision of it, but there's a lot of educators... would be really thrilled. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just expresses what they feel. But this is saying those things will come about as a result. You can't push these things. Mm-hmm. They're a consequence. They're not a cause.
We saw all the warnings about profit motive. So you see another reason for the warning, you read this, it's like, okay, so if we just pushed profit motive, then all these other things could then follow. No, right? I mean, man cannot cause growth. Doesn't matter where you grab the system, if you push it in a non-evolutionary way, change without growth is potential evil. Right? So you will get the exact opposite of what you were looking for. So, but... they just remind you, in a proper growing situation, conforming to the cosmos situation, you have this relationship to the transition away from profit motive in terms of education. When you see the militaristic to idealistic one, You know, don't think in dichotomy. Well, of course, military's bad and ideals are good. Right, what are you doing there? We're going into advancing civilization. What are we leaving behind? One of those indispensables? War, of course. Right, right. It's just, see, it's just a natural part of the thing.
This is not material idealism.
And it's definitely not material idealism, yeah. Because that would be very low quality thinking. And then instead of success seeking, cosmic grasping. Right? You know, don't be temporally successful, be eternally successful. Right? Measure your success by you know, the length and breadth and depth of your conformity to the cosmos.
What is it, good does it do to gain the whole world?
Right. Because after all, your soul is just a measure of how much the cosmos you have grasped. Right? Mm-hmm. It's just a literalization of how much you've encompassed your conformity with the cosmos. Okay, so fun stuff, you know. See, just lots of simple little things that they're giving you about the process to begin to encourage an education that's fundamentally predicated on developing and sharpening every student's relationship to the three cosmic intuitions at the foundation of human consciousness, objective consciousness. No longer helpless victims of antecedent causation. Okay, what else do they tell us here?
Education recently passed from the control of the clergy to that of lawyers and businessmen. Eventually, it must be given over to the philosophers and the scientists. Teachers must be free beings, real leaders to the end, that philosophy, the search for wisdom, may become the chief educational pursuit.
Yeah, so just stressing it again. So, you know, that basic throwing out of philosophy, you know, that began in the beginning of the 20th century, look at how that's just inescapable. She's turning us 180 degrees around. If you're going in the direction away from philosophy, are you going towards light and life or away from light and life? Right? Are you going towards you know, this chief educational pursuit they're talking about here of an advancing civilization, or 180 degrees away from it?
No, we just recently passed into the clergy. From the clergy to the lawyers and businessmen. So,
right. I mean, but good point about, I mean, just how recently in the past we broke free from the control of the clergy. You know, ecclesiasticalism. You know, into having lawyers and businessmen really leading it, and that's an appropriate, you know, step. And you notice they, you know, they try to make it very clear. Don't think about this as, well, tomorrow we're just going to, no, eventually, right? So there's a, you know, it's a long process. You know, remember how it's tied to that long process on the profit motive, as they just pointed out. So as long as the profit motive is a very significant thing, lawyers and businessmen should be, right, a major factor in what's going on. You know, the profit motive being indispensable. You know, so if there isn't an education in that regard, then civilization is going to collapse. Okay. Yep.
So you think you can have real philosophy without, without including God or the spirituals? I mean, or
no,
that whole what?
Again, absolutely not. Because I mean, in the simplest sense, you know,
people try to have that.
Well, sure, you know, you can develop so-called philosophies. You can develop doctrines. See, again, you know, see, just that whole fact that when you say the word philosophy, what should form in your mind doesn't form in any human's mind on the planet right now. I mean, all they hear is doctrine and dead philosopher, right? Some dead guy and his doctrine. Right? You know, yeah. Name your favorite dead guy and his doctrine, right? And it's like, no, that's not philosophy. Philosophy is not isms. Doctrines are isms. Philosophy is a word that was coined way back by the ancient Greeks that humans haven't figured out what it refers to yet. Yeah, even then they were struggling, and still today. Right? It's not until you have the fifth epoch of Revelation that you finally can figure out what that word is referring to. It's referring to, you know, in the simplest initial understanding of human philosophy, that lower hemisphere of the full sphere of philosophy. Right? It's the superadditive consequence of the relationship between science and religion. Right? If there's no God, there's no genuine religion. So there's no, even if there is genuine science, there is no genuine superadditive consequence. There is no genuine philosophy. Right? There is no genuine philosophy without God. Right? Philosophy is predicated on those three cosmic intuitions. In terms of that's what's self-evident. You know, what does it say in paper 102? Let's just go there and remind ourselves quickly. So if you get those, if you develop and sharpen your three cosmic intuitions, a number of things you'll just know, a number of things will be self-evident through the insight of those three cosmic intuitions. Of all the things that you can just know that are self-evident, one thing is the most trivially, immediately, and absolutely known. Of God, the most inescapable of all presences, the most real of all facts, the most living of all truths, the most loving of all friends, the most divine of all values, we have the right to be the most certain of all universe experiences. Okay, where's that certainty come from? Is it coming from the dictionary's definition of faith? Credulous belief? No. It's coming from genuine validation of the fact of God, which comes through your three cosmic intuitions, foundationally through the third.
You have to experience it.
And the only way you can experience is it because you're in circuit in the Holy Spirit, you have the three cosmic intuitions. You have no other way to get to God except through your insight. You're a long ways away from sight of God on the Isle of Paradise as a finaliter. Right? Insight is your only means. Right? But it's, you know, it's just as that paragraph says there in 102.7. Right? It is the most trivial of self-evident facts to a genuine human mind. So think about these incredibly brilliant intellects that have lived, that have developed these massive, elaborate doctrines that have no God in them. Is that a human construct? No, that's a fancy animal construct, that elaborate doctrine. Because God would be at the nucleus of the construct if it was a human construct. Because that's the most trivial nuclear fact in a human's mind.
And yet, we all experience so many human minds that totally deny it.
Right. See, so why do we still call them human minds? Because they're by grace human. Superconsciously, they know God.
I'll say mortals.
And see, that brilliant intellect that developed that elaborate doctrine. Okay, God is not in his conscious mind. Right? God is obviously not in his conscious mind because it's not part of his construct. But by grace, God is in his superconscious mind. And he's technically a human, but he's not availing himself of his humanity. It's still a superconscious fact. Right? Or God would be the nucleus of his construct. Okay. Okay. So.
So love them and forgive them, and just.
I mean, you know, they're a child of God, but we're, you know, the whole point of the fifth epical revelation is to bring those superconscious things as part of your conscious life. The only way to do that is to take delight in cultivating. You have to reflect. It's only through reflective thinking that which is right now superconscious can become a conscious possession. Right? Every single human by grace has genuine, real faith, superconsciously. Right? But obviously, it's not a conscious possession because it's not, the definition is not in the dictionary. Right? If we'd gotten up consciously to it, there would be an appropriate definition in the dictionary of faith. The act of recognizing the validity of spiritual consciousness. Right? That's not the definition of the dictionary. That's the definition in your Rashi book. Credulous belief is the definition of the dictionary. Right. No recognition that's like, no, it has nothing to do with belief. It's a validation act. Right? You don't believe in some notion of God with endless zeal. Right? You know of the existence of the real God. You've validated the fact of God. It's like, well, how could I do that? Because you've been given an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, a means of validating such a transcendent fact. Right? So it has nothing to do with believing in the existence of God. You've literally validated his existence independently, just you. No input from anyone else. You, unto yourself, have validated his existence, and that's why you believe in his existence, because you validated his existence. Right? Your belief is predicated on faith. Okay.
Which keeps getting better, or I don't know if the right words are. I mean, that validation doesn't just occur and then end, so to speak.
Right. No, that becomes, once you get up to the sixth level of meaning, and what I was just saying is a fact of your consciousness, right? Now you have really begun, you've been really born again, right? And everything now is predicated on that foundation. Everything stems from that foundation. Like you're saying, it just grows and grows and grows. The consequences of the foundational fact of your human nature. All right, so again, you're just, you know, eventually it's given over to the philosopher. So again, this, to the end that philosophy, the search for wisdom, may become the chief educational pursuit. And, remember, the literalness of the word philosophy is the intellectual condition of actively loving wisdom. And, Sophia is wisdom, right? Okay, I mean, we coined it. We knew it had something to do with wisdom. But have we ever figured out the physics of, like that I just described a little bit ago, how you get to wisdom, you know, that you have these three cosmic intuitions and you penetrate into the experience and, you know, those experiences that result from tribulation, et cetera, et cetera. No, we haven't figured out all that physics, and we certainly haven't figured out the super additive consequence thing. Okay. But we do have a vague notion that has something to do with wisdom, even if we can't really define what wisdom is. Or how you get it. All right. So again, you know, you see very much, you know, where they're talking, they're bringing up education here. If you want to be getting into the second phase of the developmental epics, it has, as the names of developmental epochs, you know, indicate, it has to transition over from people being dominated by either science or religion, say, it has to go up and around into a holistic space. That's what that advancing civilization is about. There's, the parts are not divorced from a whole anymore. The whole comes first, and then all the parts advance within that holistic context. That's advancing civilization. All right, let's read this little predicate to this list here, and I'll explain what this list is about.
Education is the business of living. It must continue throughout a lifetime so that mankind may gradually experience the ascending levels of mortal wisdom, which are.
Okay. So, when you, as you get some of the more basic lists, if you will, or some of the more basic physics of the fifth epical revelation under your belt, like you definitely solidly have a hold of the seven adjutants, say, you've gone from there, and you have a solid grip on the levels of meaning. This is one of the next things that you can begin to put into that ever more complete physics of reality that you're beginning to think in terms of. There's seven ascending levels of mortal wisdom. So levels of wisdom. Once you get up to the sixth level of meaning, as I was just saying a moment ago, so that you have fully initiated your human nature, then you want to think about, well, I'm up to the ceiling in the levels of meaning. Do I just build a tabernacle there and dwell there forever on that apparent mountaintop? No. All right. That's a beginning. Now you're going to move up cosmic levels. Right. Once you are genuinely engaged with the cosmos, now you could begin to move up cosmic levels. Like, think about the psychic circles are cosmic levels. How much circle progress have you made if you don't know the definition of the word faith experientially? All right. Okay, but see, I've often said that, if you think about the levels of meaning as a ladder, you move to the ladder and then you sort of pull up the ladder and then you can take the levels of meaning and turn it into a horizontal circular structure. Well, it was a vertical linear thing, wrap it around, stick the ends together, and those levels become facets of a cosmic character up there. Right, an ever higher quality cosmic character as you move up cosmic levels. In other words, you move up levels of wisdom. Right? And so in terms of, say mortal wisdom. So in any sort of a beginning sense, what are the levels that you have to move up? So they give you some labels, if you will, some little clues, a set of words that's a reminder of what those first seven levels are that you move up once you've really started, once you're really God-knowing and not just, knowing about some notion of God, but knowing the real God. And that paragraph I read from 102.7 is part of your experience, not just part of your zeal about some notion of God, right? But as a genuine trans-emotional acquirement that leads to emotions subsequently, right? But it's not merely just an emotional state about your belief in some notion of God. Okay, once you get up there, so let's read this list of little You know, bullet point reminders of what those levels are about, and I'll explain it.
One, the knowledge of things. Two, the realization of meanings. Three, the appreciation of values. Four, the nobility of work, duty. Five, the motivation of goals, morality. Six, the love of service, character. Seven, cosmic insight, spiritual discernment.
Okay. You've got one little sentence after that, too, that we'll get in a minute here. That's the big cherry on top of all this. But, okay, so it says that there are levels of wisdom, levels of mortal wisdom. In other words, mortal wisdom, human philosophy, right? That whole lower hemisphere of human philosophy, these are all part of that lower hemisphere of human philosophy, mortal wisdom. Okay, so you go, okay, levels of wisdom, you go, okay, so what's number one? The knowledge of things. Well, wait a minute, I thought knowledge was different than wisdom. Man, isn't it the quest for knowledge and wisdom? If those two words meant the same thing, why would they call the next developmental epic knowledge and wisdom? Okay, what do they mean? Like I said, this is a little set of words to remind you of what that level of wisdom is about. Okay, the only way I can acquire wisdom is through tribulation, right? Insight into the experience that I had through tribulation. So each one of these is ascending levels of tribulation. Okay? A first rudimentary way that you could experience tribulation is if there's lots of holes in your knowledge of things. You have a very poor knowledge of things. And, you trip over that fact. There's tribulation that results from your, inadequate knowledge of things. Okay, that's your initial wisdom. Is through that inadequate knowledge of things. And it just moves up from there. Holes in your, deficits in the realization of meanings, leading to tribulation. Deficits in the appreciation of values leading to tribulation. And it should be starting, it's like, well, what's an example of that? It should start to feel very abstract and intangible. Because, we're still kind of just in a mode where it's kind of hard for us to even imagine what exactly would each of these levels would be about. We're kind of looking up at that first level, and that seems pretty obvious. Oh, yeah, I get the knowledge of things. Imagine before you really had knowledge, though. Before the scientific age, what would some primitive human do with them telling you, the first level of wisdom is about tribulation relative to the knowledge of things? And they go, what? What is that? Right? Before there was knowledge of things. Back when everything is just innately inscrutable, right? It's all, the things are all just being puppeted by whimsical, spirits. There is no knowledge of things, right? What's there to know? And it's like, all there is just a fear of, who knows what it's going to do next. So obviously you can't, you don't have the predicate for that level of wisdom until you have science. See, and again, right? It's a level of philosophic quality, it's a level of wisdom. So it's going to have to be science and religion, there to have a super additive consequence of philosophy. The higher the level of philosophy, the more science and religion is going to have to go into it in that super additive sense to get you up to that higher level. But see, that's the whole thing, So, if there's tribulation that results from issues with the motivation of goals, you know, et cetera, all these, and all the way up to seven, you know, there's, you know, sort of the fullness of cosmic insight. See, when all is said and done, you have that sort of final challenge as you're moving up these levels of just a raw incompleteness of your cosmic insight. And again, spiritual discernment, Holy Spirit, not partly Spirit. Okay, so, you know, that should give you a little sense. So you move up these levels of wisdom, you know, and every time you get up to some peak in some sequence of levels, there's an evolutionary process, and eventually, right, there's some eventuated subsequent hierarchy you move up that's a coordination of the ladder that you just went up before. Like, you know, think about how just as an animal, you're moving up a ladder of adjutants. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They're just stacked in a vertical ladder. But then once you're encircled in the Holy Spirit, roughly age 6, right, no longer is that ladder of 7 adjutants there. I mean, there's a coordination that encompasses all that. They get coordinated into a new, higher set of levels. Like the first 3 adjutants form the first level of meaning. The next 3 adjutants form the second level of meaning. The 7th adjutant forms the 3rd level of meaning. See how that former ladder got re-coordinated into the foundation for a subsequent set of levels that you move up. An animal doesn't have levels of meaning, because meaning is a superadditive consequence of a relationship between things and values. Right? An animal's a thing, but it has no connection to values. So there can't be a superadditive consequence of meaning. Right? And you don't either until roughly age 6, you're encircled in the Holy Spirit. You're given the 3rd cosmic intuition, which is a recognition of values. You now have a connection to values. You're a thing by nature. The two can come together in a superadditive consequence. There can be meaning for the first time. And there can be levels of meaning then. So, like I said, you know, the same thing you can see here. Until you have all 3 cosmic intuitions, which are a prerequisite for wisdom, how could you be moving up levels of wisdom? At best, you're just going to be parroting, you know, the adages of the past. But they're not going to be a courageous, independent acquirement, you know, that you've achieved as an absolutely unique personality.
The levels of wisdom, mm-hmm. You're saying that the levels of meaning, when you have these levels of wisdom, you like wrap around.
Well, just, you know, think of all that you've built up in terms of meaning, moving up the levels of meaning. All that gets incorporated into each level of wisdom.
So
however you want to analogize that.
When you were saying that, and how they wrap around like facets earlier, yeah. That kind of reminded me of, and you said the psychic circles, that it's not only that you reach a psychic circle, but you have to fill it out in a complete way. So to me, that was a way that it gave it vertical and horizontal, or complete, and I don't know if the right word would be replete, but there was a sense of fullness or wholeness when you did that.
Yeah.
Because you got...
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, the when I, you know, the kind of the immediate literalness of picturing taking these levels and putting them, you know, the vertical ladder and making it horizontal and wrapping it around and having, you know, what was a step on the ladder becoming a face on a on a closed structure. I mean, the literalness of that is the facets of cosmic character. You know, where you can literally, you know, think about, you know, how tolerance, you know, forgiveness, you know, what have you, those elements of cosmic character are predicated on levels of meaning. You know, like forgiveness, you know, what's the cosmic definition of forgiveness? Patient love. Oh, so in other words, you combine the third level with the sixth level, and you have forgiveness.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Right? So you can literally kind of picture it in simple fashion.
Okay.
But I mean, the whole point is that, you know, all that you, you're not burning your bridges as you move up any of these things. You're accumulating all this, and so when you get to the top and transcend that particular hierarchy, you eventuate, you encompass all of that, you know, into the foundation of the levels above.
Can you describe a little bit further, since these are going to be in regard to tribulation? Can you help me with tribulation?
Again, it's just you know, like I said, you can easily get the idea of the knowledge of things, right? I mean, you know, you I didn't know that blue flames are hot. ouch! Oh, now I have a knowledge of that thing. Right, as a tribulation, right, the literal physical pain. You know, so you know, I mean, the easiest way to, you know, for us to, you know, interpret tribulation is a literal physical thing. But obviously, the higher we move up these levels of wisdom, the less it's going to be a tribulation, you know, of like stubbing your toe. See, it's going to be higher and higher levels of conflict. You know, you're going to have this effort, and you're going to struggle, and you're going to come to this, into this conflict. You know, and there's going to be this tribulation in your mind. Remember how, they speak of that turmoil, that, you know, to establish a new level of philosophic relationship to the cosmos involves, you know, a very holistic upsetting of everything. Great mental tribulation, as all your most cherished rationalization schemes are just eviscerated, right? All of your most cherished notions about your relationship to God and the effectiveness of prayer and et cetera, all just get gutted, for instance. And again, the revelation is constructed in that way where once you start to engage it philosophically, you start to see the points where they've set up the conditions for subsequent tribulation. Right? Eventually, you get a little bit more precise in your examination of the book. And you notice, there's this really harsh word I noticed in the book. Abomination. You go, well, I'll bet you abomination is sequestered somewhere in one of the dusty parts of part two or something, you know, where some young innocent, you know, student won't stumble into it right away. No, the word abomination occurs three times in the book, and all three of them are in the Jesus papers. And the very first one tells you that your prayer is an abomination. That's pretty harsh. It's like, if you want to be technical about it, what's the quality of your prayer? It's rather low quality. The only word I can think of that appropriately matches the lowness of the quality is abomination. Okay. Is that Jesus out with the masses 2,000 years ago, and some poor struggling person, you know, who's barely can feed themselves, and he walks up to him and says, "Oh, my child, your prayer is an abomination, you know, to God." No. But the fifth epic of Revelation says that. That's rugged truth. I mean, that's harsh. That's not something you should be, you know, sticking into some poor little child of God's face. That's in the Jesus papers. Abomination, abomination. I mean, again, that's, you know, there's great tribulation when you have to face just how tadpole your prayer is. Okay? That will produce great tribulation, right? You know, think about how someone like Martin Luther, say, or Mother Teresa struggled, you know, great drops of sweat pouring from their face as they sort of recognize just how lowly their tadpole estate is. All right, that's tribulation. And now either that drags you down and you sort of lose your humanity in that tribulation, that wrenching, you know, of your soul, as it were, you know, as we often speak of it. You rise above it. Effort, struggle, conflict, faith. Belief is not going to get you through that tribulation. Belief, as those people testified, evaporated in the face of the tribulation of mind. And they were struggling, trying to find any way out of this seemingly hopeless estate that they found themselves in. See, again, yeah, humans need that genuine faith. You know, it, in many of those cases, it they died trying to find it still, right? And couldn't find that, you know. You see, that genuine upward grasp, right, that can get you above, and where you can, despite all appearances of the contrary, you can validate reality that seems to be evaporating in the midst of your confusion. You can rise above that and use that validating mechanism that belief doesn't, you know, is no part of belief. Yep.
And even in the, when they talk, when they say about Jesus and ignominious death. But, you know, I also think of the wisdom side of things is not, can also be, we can also learn from each other. And we can get, you know, your experience with this and that, and my experience with that. And I think to be honest with you, as we grow and as we evolve, not just here on Earth, but throughout eternity, you know, we are able to all begin to understand the experiences of all one another and be able to, you know, make that a part of our own to a certain degree. Yeah. So that, you know, you don't have to get, if you can share in some of the wisdom that I got when I, you know, hey, I touched that, it was hot, oh, okay. In other words, that's crude, but
you
I'm just
saying.
Yeah,
from history.
Yeah, right. Okay, so yeah, very good point. Okay, so let's bring in that one little element. Is the only way to experience tribulation is by walking a mile in certain moccasins? No, one can learn by looking as well as by leaping, right, as the Revelation says. So, you discover the hot stove and you tell me about it, okay, and but you know, either I'm so minimally human that just doesn't sink in, and I have to go through the same experience again in order for me to get it, or I have some human insight. See, and you can describe the experience to me. I can penetrate into that description of that experience, the tribulation of it, and gain the wisdom. It's important to recognize that you do have to actually you know, you said to a certain degree, I think you kind of said when you're thinking about the collective, you know, help. Yeah. See, but to a certain degree, but eventually you as an individual have to penetrate with your insight into the situation in order for it to really cement within you.
Experiences. A lot of experiences that you may have, I may never have, so to speak. So, but I may be able to gain from some of the things you've learned or wisdom that you've gotten out of it, because I would never experience that to some degree.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I don't know how you, when they talk about, exchanging your mind for the mind of Jesus, and you try and think about how do I do that? And they say, well, it's kind of as simple as taking on somebody else's ideas as your own, so to speak. But then you want to practice that in your own life and being able to do that. It takes, I don't know if effort's the right word, but it definitely takes, really getting into it and trying to do it. And I think from, gaining some of the, as you read the revelation in it and you understand, how it seems to play out in your life and the life of others, I seem to get a lot from, listening to you, for instance, and listening to other people that I know. I learn a lot more than I could just ever experience on my own.
And all of that is so definitely true. I mean, none of us can do this on our own. But just recognize there's that final cherry on the top, if you will, that only you can supply. Remember, they threw in that self-realizing thing there. Right? I mean, your personality is absolutely unique. Okay? My personality can't do it for you. Right? The final realization, where it becomes part of your reality, something that is actually copied into your soul and isn't just passing through, my experience is passing through you, but you don't realize them, hence they don't get made your soul substance. Eventually you have to bring that full encompassment of personal insight and surround that and make it your possession. Again, paper 102 is very strong about that. In cosmic grasping again, that whole just, they're trying to get you to visualize it, that you have to individuate it. You have to encompass it and individuate it out of your environment, of which I'm a part. My wisdom is just part of your environment. I can catalyze your acquirement of that so that, we don't have to all literally experience everything ourselves. Again, it's part of that eventuation thing. It's just like the fact that you can, get to seventh adjutant, roughly, if you take 5 years, 10 months, plus 9 months, right? So 6 years, 7 months, right? You can get from first adjutant to seventh adjutant, in that little span of time, instead of having to take 450 million years.
When you talked about doing the grasping thing and making it individualized, is that taking something's potential and actualizing it, or is that just initiating potential?
Well, see, I mean, there's this actuality, like he's talking about, like my experiences, he can benefit from that. There's an actuality that can come into his mind, but he has to do that final step of realityizing it with his personality, his grasp.
It's almost as if it doesn't, it's almost as if he never communicated it.
Yeah.
So as soon as he communicates it. Yeah. When it goes to Jesus and it talks about paper 196, it goes on to say, you can be assured that, that Michael has, fully experienced the life of a human, let's say a creator, here, and knows exactly, all the tribulations and so on and so forth. Now, he hasn't necessarily experienced my life, but in experiencing that, he's gotten that part of the supreme or whatever that he really needed to be able to have experience at all, so to speak, that he created.
Again, see, that's a reminder of you can learn by looking as well as by leaping. Right, okay. See? I mean, he didn't have to, like, you know, he didn't even make it to 40, let alone 80. He knows nothing of how decrepit, you know, we become when we're 80, okay? You know, it's like, well, yeah, it's easy when you're in your 30s, dude, But, you know, remember, that was a big point of what he did going around the Mediterranean, right? Is, you know, he's trying to get to that first circular, right? And it requires a lot of learning by looking, plus, you know, some learning by leaping, too. But there's a lot of, you know, he engages all these other people, young and old, of every, you know, from every, you know, quarter of the world, right, to try to flesh out through learning, through, you know, all of his learning, through both looking and leaping. Okay? So that when all is said and done, right, again, he didn't have to walk a mile in every moccasin. See? It's just, notice how brainwashed we are by that. It's very difficult to break out if we've been brainwashed since we were little kids that you don't know anything about something unless you've walked a mile in the moccasins. You have to break from that, right? That's a limited truth, if you will. And you can learn by looking as well as by leaping.
Some people can.
Right, but see, only a human can learn by looking. An animal has to learn everything by leaping. See, because only a human has insight. Right? Yep.
This list of seven,
yep.
It talks about levels, so my first inclination is to, well, you have to do one first, then two, then three.
Yep.
When you look at the list and think about it, no, you have to do them kind of, they all play off of one another, so you kind of have to do them all at the same time to some degree.
Well, right. Again, remember the high. You know, once you go beyond kind of, the kind of very linear levels of the adjutants, right? All the levels above that, more and more, they're each level is not an island unto itself, like you're saying, right? I mean, right? You're moving up a level, yes, but you're also working on the previous level. I mean, that's why when you get to the top, you don't just have the top level. You have it in all the levels you've already gone up to, because you haven't burned any bridges, right? The kind of level one wisdom that you can achieve when you're up to seventh level
doesn't disappear.
You know, I mean, there's level one wisdom that can only be achieved when you get up also to the seventh level there. Okay. So,
and it's interesting too that they didn't say that I may gradually experience.
Mm-hmm.
Just mankind may gradually experience.
Yeah, right. Because remember the context we're in. We're talking about it. You know, advancing civilization. Right. So, not only do you have individuals moving up these, but that's being socialized into a civilization so that everyone is moving up those levels as well. It's, you know, it's not that different from talking about the individual mode of an adjutant and the collective mode of an adjutant. Right? So it's one thing for the seventh adjutant to dawn in you. You know, it's a much bigger thing when the seventh adjutant dawns in the collective. But there's no way it can dawn in the collective if it hasn't first dawned in all the individuals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, remember, we're in this development of the state. We have citizens, right? And the whole thing is predicated on those individuals. You know, the civilization is in each citizen. There isn't some sort of just civilization and you can just plop an individual into it and ta-da, they're civilized. No, the civilization has to be in the individual, and then it, you know, it socializes outward into a collective phenomenon. But you won't get anything collectively if it's not in the individuals. It's like, how did civilization get from Europe to North America. It came in vessels called future citizens of a state, right? Right. The civilization was in those individuals that came across the Atlantic Ocean. Okay.
Civilization, you're saying, and the book says, is more like an outer consequence or reflection. You can't just have plop a civilization. It's coming from that, those groups of individuals.
Can't rise any higher than the quality of the individuals.
Yeah.
And, so just...
So plopping in people that don't have...
Yeah, right. Yeah, and see, and again, that's how you can destroy it. If you bring in a whole bunch of people that are incapable of possessing civilization within them, what's going to happen to the civilization without? It's going to evaporate. And so again, remember, you know, they're talking about all this advancing philosophy, these levels of wisdom. Right? When you think about that. Second phase of the progress of civilization, that advancing phase, you have to have more than merely citizens of states. An advancing civilization is predicated on individuals who are first cosmic citizens, and then that casts a shadow down as a citizen of a state of a higher quality. See, and that's what gets you from the early phase to the advancing phase. Yeah. So that's why the Revelations, he's talking about cosmic citizens. Again, the early phase is bottom-up, citizens, and the advancing phase, fundamentally those are top-down citizens. Right? So I mean you're reciprocating, the individuals as you go from the early phase to the advancing phase. It's all predicated on cosmic consciousness, cosmic citizens produce this innately higher quality earthly citizen. Okay, and then they just throw in one delightful little tease, a little sentence at the end.
And then, by means of these achievements, many will ascend to the mortal ultimate of mind attainment, God consciousness.
Okay. I'm not going to go into the physics of this. I mean, it's something we do in Reawakening Philosophy. If you ever take that those seminars. But just note a couple things here. That if I move up these seven levels of mortal wisdom, there's going to be some eventually where they get coordinated into some higher set of levels, and they do, and they talk about that in another part of the book, and that culminates in something called God consciousness. So here you can begin to get a little of a sense, even if we don't go into all the additional physics of it. All of this, you couldn't get to level one of mortal wisdom until you first got up to the sixth level of meaning, until you got up to God knowingness. Okay, so that's the beginning of your philosophic journey. Again, you asked about philosophy without God. Okay, see, the beginning of your genuine philosophic journey is God knowingness. Right? And it apparently moves up to where you're really fraternizing with supremacy, but can keep going. You notice what they said there. The mortal ultimate of mind attainment? Okay. So just how rarefied a state is this God, this seemingly innocent God consciousness word? Right? Like I've tried to stress, right? When you see God conscious or God conscious in the book, okay, I mean, you think mankind hasn't figured out what the definition of faith is, okay? We are so far from what they're talking about there, Right? That is a very, very high state. You know, and they point out, you know, if you read all the places about the, you know, about God consciousness in the book, you know, they explain that, you know, you don't even have a word really to describe such a high a state. They've elected to just use that word God consciousness to describe this. But you can, you know, if you, the more you study, the more you get this idea, oh, this is something way up. I've got to move up to a very transcendent philosophic state of mind. My personal living philosophy is going to be way, way, way up beyond the stratosphere, right? Fraternizing with ultimacy. I was like, well, how is that even possible? I mean, I thought it was a finite being. I mean, wouldn't the limit be fraternizing with supremacy? Oh, so you just, so in other words, beyond these levels of mortal wisdom, those subsequent levels must innately involve the adjuster. See, you just, if you just think about it logically, oh, so without even finding the spot in the book yet about that physics, right? I mean, who comes down from the absolute, even, you know, down from the infinite even, you know, down to, from the absolute through the ultimate, right, down to supremacy to meet you, right? So if you get a synchronization of that adjuster, you could be fraternizing through the adjuster with ultimacy, okay? And have a state of mind called God consciousness.
And they say Jesus.
Okay. Okay. So just
hard to fathom.
Very, very humble tadpole when you run across the God conscious or God consciousness in the book. Just, you know, try to, you know, never let yourself illusions of success. As it were, about, oh yeah, God conscious. Oh, I'm really God conscious. Okay. Okay. Anyway, so this is a. You know, you can see there's all kinds of intense detail, because they're trying to encourage you to get out of, you know, these fuzzy, imaginative, you know, primitive religious states of mind, right? There's a whole complex science, physics, as I often say, nature to all this, you know, and a level of religious consciousness that is, you know, hasn't been recorded in human history, that come together to give a philosophic frame of mind that can reach incredible heights, can culminate in a fraternizing with ultimacy. So, it should, you know, it should spur you on. The untapped potential, right, of each of us as individuals, not to mention, what if a significant fraction of the citizens of a state were in this mode? Remember the four indispensables of advancing civilization: true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Oh, so. So what kind of an advanced civilization are we talking about where basically you are socializing God-conscious citizens? Whoa, we're talking way deep in light and life somewhere.
But many worlds are there.
Yeah. There's lots and lots of worlds that are there.
Amazing.
All right, imagine the culture on such a world, right? Imagine the civilization on such a world. Okay. Let's get into the final section here.
Section 8, the character of statehood. The only sacred feature of any human government is the division of statehood into the three domains of executive, legislative, and judicial functions. The universe is administered in accordance with such a plan of segregation of functions and authority. Aside from this divine concept of effective social regulation or civil government, it matters little what form of state a people may elect to have provided the citizenry as ever progress.
Provided the citizenry
is ever progressing toward the goal of augmented self-control and increased social service. The intellectual keenness, economic wisdom, social cleverness, and moral stamina of a people are all faithfully reflected in statehood.
Notice that final statement is what we're just touching upon over and over again there. You have this quality in the individual, and it's reflected outward into the collective phenomenon, the group phenomenon, in the statehood. And you notice even the adverb that they threw in there, faithfully reflected. See, again, just, you know, that the nucleus of the sphere of your personal living philosophy is faith, genuine faith. So it all, you know, is leveraged off of that nucleus of your genuine human nature. Okay, so, you know, we've brought this up several times. You know, here it is, and, you know, directly stated that you've got this divine concept, right, of the three branches of government. The only sacred feature. Again, you know, you just marvel at how long it took without, you know, the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve to get to the first nation. The first territorial state that had three branches of government in its constitution. Very recent, like you say, so many of these things are so recent and hence so tenuous.
And it's been about a million years since
Yes, right. Yep. The first kind of preaching about the divine by Anagar, right, almost a million years ago. But took us a long time to get to this, for that religious nucleus to give rise to a philosophic consciousness that would produce a government with three branches. Okay? Again, I mean, we have three branches in our Constitution because the Founding Fathers we're standing on the shoulders of the giants of evolutionary philosophy. Reflective thinking, evolutionary philosophy produced that recognition. An insight into the cosmos, you know, produced that recognition that there needed to be three branches of government. You go, well, where did that come from? It came down from above, right? As they state directly there, the universe is administered in accordance with such a plan of segregation. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Notice in there, not only the increased social service, but what's it predicated on? Augmented self-control. You know, ever more self-control. Not self-assertion. Yeah, that's the battle cry of the rebellion. Ever more. Right. The opposite. Ever more self-control. Right, so that eventually you have just profound self-mastery in the citizens. Right? I mean, the self-mastery of the citizens in a world enlightened life would just be, you know, beyond our imagination. Right?
Meaning, if we were to see that, we probably would think they were dull.
Yes. Yes. Where's the drama?
No. Or maybe
they'd be so dynamic. The trouble is, the beauty of them is, you know, would be invisible to our crude eyes. Right?
You think
think paradise is boring.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, remember what you see on the Isle of Paradise if you're taken there right now. Nothing. Right. Okay, so then they move into a list, another list here. You know, read the preface in number one there.
The evolution of statehood entails progress from level to level as follows. One, the creation of a threefold government of executive, legislative, and judicial branches.
Okay, so you can probably kind of feel how this is going to sum up a lot of what we've read. You know, we had things like in section four, we had the progressive program of an expanding civilization embraces, and they gave you those 12. You know, or back there in section two, there are 10 steps or stages to the evolution of a practical and efficient form of representative government, and these are. So they're going to bring these together, you know, into, you know, sort of a summary fashion in many ways in this list. But you see, again, it's level to level. And level one, you haven't begun in genuine terms until you have three branches of government. Right, and so again, how, you know, we know it's not that long ago. For the spear point of this phenomenon, the United States, remember, it hasn't even been 10 years. You know, we aren't even 10 years hence for the United Kingdom. You know, they that recently have a Supreme Court. Yeah. A genuine third branch of their government. Right. So, you know, they've just begun these levels there. Till you have three branches, you know, and you might even say, it's like, well, maybe they're sort of like halfway on, you know, have begun, because it still kind of isn't, you know, the judicial branch is still kind of, you know, tentative and embryonic. Okay. But, you know, just that's, you know, when you're, if you, to get anywhere significant, right, you have to start there. And so, you can look in a lot of places on the planet and not find the beginning here. So, how far is the planet away from the year of light and life? ways away. Okay, number two.
Number two, the freedom of social, political, and religious activities.
Yeah, we've seen that. You know, that freedom. So, just, you know, we don't have to elaborate a lot on all these, but just. Yeah, notice how things get summarized in this very definitive levels as you move up here.
Three, abolition of all forms of slavery and human bondage.
Yeah. So we notice the all forms. See, again, you know, how, and we saw how they stressed that before. So it's not enough to just, you know, literally get rid of the leg chains. Okay, on a few people. All forms of slavery and human bondage. All right.
Number four, the ability of the citizenry to control the levying of taxes.
See how it's right there again? You know that's part of that human bondage, the tax confusion thing. So, you know, again, you can see how, you know, it's going to... You start eroding, you know, as you're moving up these levels. You know, we got three branches, we start moving up, but then you start eroding, you know, say three and four, and you're going to move down. Eventually, one is going to start to fall apart, right? The branches are going to get blurry, right? Okay. So, again, it's, you notice how it comes up again. I mean, it's not some ideological agenda on my part. The taxes thing is huge. That was it was just an immediate wake of us corrupting our Constitution. Right, that the revelators are writing this.
Don't they give us the tax percentage? They give it a pretty good outline.
Well, yeah, they give you a number of things. I mean, they give you examples of what it's like in light and life and things like that, right? Yeah. Right, you know, but still, Yeah, just, you know, and then, and that whole bit about the ability of the citizenry to control the levying of the taxes, you know, how much does it get out of the citizens' hands? And it's like, well, I'm just a helpless victim, you know, of the state, you know, and they're just going to tell me, you know.
To a large degree, it's out of the hands of our elected representatives as well. Because an insidious form of taxation that's not generally recognized is borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another way of taxing without actually
making people write a making project. It so literal. Right, and you notice, again, you're reminded, you know, slavery and human bondage, all forms of human bondage, all these different ways that we can be in bondage to debt, and you know, all these different ways that we can be in bondage. You know, and you've got to get to the point where the citizens are, you know, in full control of that, or you're not going to get up to number 12 here, okay? Right, if that's not definitive.
Isn't that the whole point of the United States? No taxation without representation?
Yeah, government of the people, by the people, for the people, right? All those ways, you know, that we're you know, that's slipping. Right? You know, we could talk for hours about all the examples. You know, government departments that think they're independent of any oversight by the executive branch, the legislative branch, and certainly of citizens having oversight over them. We have all of these cancers, right, and our integrity in these hierarchies. And so the more, when you introduce a cancer into one of these levels, so you're breaking your relationship to the cosmos, less and less is there going to be spiritual gravity lifting you up through these levels, right? Material gravity is going to drag you back down through those levels until you go through the floor, right? And you have to start all over again to what leads up to one of these level ones, right? Okay.
Number 5, the establishment of universal education, learning extended from the cradle to the grave.
So again, you know, bottom line, okay, that's going to be one of the big, you know, that's going to be one of the big bullet points. There it is again, education, cradle to grave, universal education. You know, so horizontally and every way, you know, universal education.
Number 6, the proper adjustment between local and national governments.
Okay. So, I mean, some of these, I mean, you know, there's lots you can say just in and of themselves, but just the order is fascinating. And so the proper adjustment between local and national governments is predicated on the education. And so you can start to understand some of the causality of how things are falling apart. You know, why does it start to get all, you know, mixed up about, you know, the proper systemization of the different spheres of government? Right? Because it requires a lot of philosophic consciousness to properly put the federal in its place, the state in its place, you know, the county, the municipal, etc. I mean, there's a whole vast philosophic system there that you have to encompass to appreciate why a certain thing should be where it is in that structure. And it's all predicated on an education, see.
And how change without wisdom is...
Yeah,
potentially evil.
Right, and if you don't know why, you know, this is in the municipality and this is in the national, and you say, well, yeah, that's just arbitrary. It appears. Let's move it. Right. Let's put the take it from the school board and put it at the national level. It's just going to destroy the whole thing. You know, and
it talks about systems. It talks about any little part of that thing.
Yeah.
That if it's misplaced.
Yeah.
Or
right.
That
It disrupts the whole system. Yeah.
That it won't work.
Yeah.
Even in this place.
Right. See, and the only way you can know how, you know, how important, you know, a slight little misalignment of a part in the system is if you have a system consciousness. Right, a philosophic consciousness. You can't have just a scientific consciousness, you know, where you just focus in on this part. Yeah, focus in on this part. You have to have a philosophic consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, until you don't understand just how delicate this is. You can't just wiggle that a little bit. Right, you'll disrupt the integrity of the whole system. All right.
Number 7, the fostering of science and the conquest of disease.
You know, remember how they saw how they stressed that, how science was a key element. Okay.
Number 8, the due recognition of sex equality and the coordinated functioning of men and women in the home, school, and church, with specialized service of women in industry and government.
By the time you get to the end of the statement, You notice the modifier on recognition at the beginning of the statement. You got to avoid undue recognition, right? Men and women literally aren't born equal, right? They aren't physically and mentally equal, right? And so, you know, you've got, yes, there's, and, but notice how by the end of the statement, you know, they're reminding you of the inescapable differences, right? With specialized service of women in industry and government. Oh my goodness gracious, is that politically incorrect to say? Right? Yeah, you'll get burned at the stake these days for that statement. Right? But you go, well, why would they say specialized service, you know, in industry and government? Well, if you don't have a qualifier, what happens to the home? Are men going to be the foundation for the home? I don't think so. Right? You notice that was mentioned there. Right? The coordinated function of men and women in the home. Is it women and men in the home, or is it men and women in the home? Who's the foundational element of the home? Right, right. Right. You have to keep that in mind. I mean, it doesn't matter how high and lofty your imaginings about your civilization are. I mean, all institutions are predicated on the home and the family.
But they didn't stop with the home. They added
school and church, right?
So, in a way, perhaps women are foundational for the church as well.
There's a number of things there. Right. I mean, well, you know, think about, you know, if the purpose of religion is to ennoble the three cosmic intuitions, do the three cosmic intuitions come from mother or father? Right. Yeah, so there's a number of things, right, to think about here. Now, again, we're not talking about fancy mammal mom. All right, we're talking about human mom. She has to be something besides a maternal instinct, right, to be in this system. But still, yep.
So, you know, there's women in this room. Why is that so? What's the right word? Not politically incorrect, but
controversial.
Why does it hurt so much? I mean, like with my wife, for instance, you know, that really hurts her. Mm-hmm. That makes her feel like she's, you know, labeled to be in the home. And, you know, and that's the big problem that she has right now, that she hears from, you know, macho men that, you know, my position is in the home. And that, therefore, you know, I can't have another existence, if I choose to, so to speak, and daggummit, I disagree with that.
Yeah, again, it's just,
I have a hard time answering that question.
When everyone favors their unity consciousness, it's very difficult to not think in these sweeping uniform terms. It's like, this is not saying that every woman has to be the foundation of the home. But there has to be, I mean, it doesn't matter how many men you have on the planet, you'll never have the requisite number of women in the foundation of the home, you know? And you definitely can't have all the women kind of striking step with what men do sort of instinctually, right? It just, there has to, you know, we have to figure out, we allow women to not be part of the home, but you can't have all women willing themselves out of the home, then we don't have a home anymore, and civilization collapses.
I want to say something as a woman on that, and that is, I'm really grateful as a woman to have the maternal connection.
Right, but
it's different than a man.
But you know there's some women, right, that's not the way they're wired. And as a society, we shouldn't put them in bondage to that concept that, you know, that there's something wrong with you if you don't get married and have children.
No.
You know, I mean, so, you know, we've gone from, you know, if being just universal in the mores system, that you were just completely shunned if you didn't conform to that. Every woman should get married and, you know, and have, you know, 12 children, you know, and you can swing the other way, you know, and say, well, no women need to. It's like, no, you can't think, you know, some women are going to have to, or the civilization's going to evaporate. You know.
I think, like you were saying, I think that it's definitely an individual woman's thing, from one woman to the next.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all women are not the same from one to the next.
Right.
Some women have special skills because they're women and are able to do things better because of, you know, tendencies that women have. And maybe they would be better at one thing or another wherever it is, and just be, you know, just kind of gravitate and feel more comfortable doing and love doing certain things. And when you talk about, oh, society should put women somewhere, or we should do this with women,
mm-hmm.
I think that's offensive. I think that, you know, respecting that each woman can look at, you know, what she loves to do and what she's good at and where her skills and talents are, whether that be in the home or school or church or industry or government.
Yeah, now the other, I mean, if we can't, you know, we're getting late already here, so we don't want
to. It's a long discussion.
Yeah, so we don't want to get, you know, I mean, we could talk again for 2 hours on just, you know, item number 8. But let me just, you know, one point to remember. Right now, as we consider this, all we're really running around in our minds is difference of temperament between animal females and animal males. Remember, you want to project this to a state you can't, none of us can imagine right now, of advancing civilization, where there is a personal nature in both men and women that we don't observe right now. And remember, you think there's a big difference between men and women, or that there's differences between women. You know, all women are not born equal, all men are not born equal. Okay, well, the more you bring in personality, remember, no personality. Every personality is absolutely unique. So the more you get to a personalized citizenry, the more, in a number of ways, it has utterly nothing to do whether or not they're male or female. Right? It's going to have, you know, you're going to be putting them into a harmony in a system based upon the arrangement of personalities, not the arrangement of temperaments. Okay, but you have to start out by at least recognizing the difference of temperaments between males and females, and amongst females and amongst males, and arrange them at least in the beginning stage by their temperament, their genetic temperament. But eventually, it's going to be very complicated. There'll be that and the superimposition of an absolutely unique personality where, you know, they will fit in just a certain place, like the celestial artisans arrange personalities into a harmony, right? Eventually, you'll be doing that, you know, in all of your institutions, so that an industry sings in full harmony. A government sings in full harmony. Okay? All right, keep going here.
Number 9, the elimination of toiling slavery by machine invention and the subsequent mastery of the machine age.
Just a quick comment there. I hope you recognize we've begun to eliminate, you know, the toil, you know, with machine invention, but you know, immediately the machines have become our masters. So there's a process. We've got to work through that and be, you know, and eventually master the machine age. It's, you know, more and more we've enslaved ourselves to those machines, you know. So you're dragging yourself back to number 3 and putting yourself in bondage. You know, by chaining yourself to the regiment of the machines. Okay, all right. So keep going.
I ran out of gas the other day. I know exactly where you are.
Number 10. The conquest of dialects, the triumph of a universal language.
Okay, so you should be able to feel, oh, we're moving towards light and life and stuff as we're going towards 12 here, aren't we? All right. So eventually, and again, remember how that fundamentally happens. As long as everyone is just an animal temperament, there is no getting to that. You have to everyone has got to begin to definitively transcend their animal nature, right? Mm-hmm. And be humans. Only humans can have a universal language. You're never going to have a bunch of animals having the same language. And that's why you have different languages, because everyone is animals. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If everyone was definitively human, there would be innately, automatically one language.
But animals can't talk.
Right? And so, anyway, you know. Fancy animals, you know what I mean. Okay, so, all right, so we're pushing definitely towards light and life.
11, the ending of war. International adjudication of national and racial differences by continental courts of nations presided over by a supreme planetary tribunal automatically recruited from the periodically retiring heads of the continental courts. The continental courts are authoritative. The world court is advisory, moral.
Whoa, the detail. Right, you see, isn't that interesting? So you've now gotten to the point where, you know, the variation of worlds, you know, many, many paths, but some things are coming together. You know, on every world it gets to this point. So they can give you a very precise formula of where you're heading towards. You know, they could say that to any world, not just to this world. So very interesting there, exactly how, what you want to think that you're moving towards. And notice, you know, we're obviously getting, you know, into light and life sort of territory. Have nations disappeared? No. Again. All right, nations endure for a very long time. So all this foolishness that we should forget about nations, right? You know, and just be a world people, right? Is that will bring nothing but calamity. Okay.
Number 12, the worldwide vogue of the pursuit of wisdom, the exaltation of philosophy, the evolution of a world religion, which will presage the entrance of the planet on the earlier phases of settlement and light and life.
Okay, so very literally bring up light and life. And again, worldwide, all right, exaltation of philosophy. See, and it's in that, like I was saying, it's in that context that you finally can transcend all the animal temperament differences, animal origin temperament differences, and rise above all those religious symbols that are different. And of course, that one world religion, you know, is again something we, you know, it's not at all what you, you know, it has nothing to do with the outer life. Remember, genuine religion has nothing to do with the outer life. All of our religions are outer life notions. Pure inner life fact. So this worldwide religion is a worldwide religious nucleus in every citizen.
It says evolution.
Yeah.
So it's not a revealed religion in the sense that we
again,
think of it today. But
right. Because again, can I, it's, you know, it's within the sphere of truth, and truth is not knowledge. It's not a knowingness that can be given. I mean, you know, again, like I was saying, once you move up these levels of mortal wisdom, right, there is just finally this high quality of personal living philosophies, and everyone is innately in a kindred minds about God. See, you've gone way beyond the potential of kindred spirits that we have right now, even, right? And you've reached a level, even in regard to your relationship of God, where everyone is a kindred mind. And everyone has a common recognition of who we are and who God is and what our relationship is. So, see, sort of that cherry on the top, sort of, see, of kindred minds. All that kindred minds is predicated on three cosmic intuitions. Your relationship to the other parent, not the father, the mother. Okay. Yep.
Then do you keep moving the cherry up?
Yes, you do. Yeah, I mean, you know, these cherries on the top are always relative. Yes,
helium-filled cherries.
But you know, notice the earlier phases of settlement and light life is all they're getting us to here. Okay.
These are the prerequisites of progressive government and the earmarks of ideal statehood. Urantia is far from the realization of these exalted ideals, but the civilized races have made a beginning. Mankind is on the march toward higher evolutionary destinies. Sponsored by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
I already kind of, you know, gave the punchline away, reminding you in number one there, just how few places on the planet have threefold government. And even the United Kingdom, it's less than 10 years ago that they had, you know, a functioning Supreme Court. So, you know, like they, you know, just a reminder, like I did, Urantia is far from light and life, far from the realization of these exalted ideals. Very simple to see that. How long will it take to get everyone to step one, even? You know, how long before there isn't a Putin that wants to be everything, say? Or a near godlike figure, you know, in an Asian country.
It's a good thing he's immortal.
Whether it be China or North Korea or what have you, you know, it's a, so we've got a lot of work to do yet. You know, not to mention you can go to places on the planet and they're still in clans. They haven't even gotten to tribes yet. Okay, so yeah, that's a long tapering tail on the backside. Okay. So, next time, now for something totally different. Like I teased last time, we've got a lot of philosophy. They're going to give us an amazing science of a specific government, a government on a neighboring planet.
And we get on the Enterprise and go somewhere else.
So that's what we'll jump into next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.